Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me, as always, is a man who would like to remind you that the garage is gladiator territory, so act accordingly. Here is the captain.
Are you not entertained? It's good to be seen, and it's good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend.
This week we are very happy to be featuring Sip and Go Naked by the fantastic team of brewers over at the Tamarack Brewing Company in beautiful Lakeside, Montana. This is an unfiltered wheat ale with apricot notes that make this one delicious and refreshing beer. This one is perfect for hot and cold days and now is available year-round from the good folks over at Tamarack. Garage grade, 4.5 bottle caps out of 5. And we'd like to give some praise and thank you to our friends that helped us out with this week's beer fun. First up, cheers to Pooley in Northern Virginia.
And a big We Like Your Jib to Cat in Montreal, Canada.
Next, here's a cheers to Shelby S. in Iowa.
And a big shout to Del Mar, Central Point, Oregon.
Next, Captain, we have a shout to Leah S. in Loveland, Ohio. And last but certainly not least, we give a big thank you to Kelly and Emily from the great state of Texas. Everyone we just mentioned, well, they helped us out with this week's beer fun.
Yeah, BWERUN, beer run. Make sure you're following us on social media. We're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, and we're on Instagram at True Crime Garage. And that is enough of the business.
All right, everybody, gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime. Mike Morford is a true crime writer, blogger, researcher, and podcast host. He co-hosts the true crime podcast Criminology. He has extensively researched and consulted on the Zodiac Killer and Golden State Killer cases. The Morph, as he is often affectionately referred to as, is an expert on all things Zodiac Killer and all things Golden State Killer. So, Mike, welcome to the garage. And I want to start off by asking you, why are those two cases so important to you? You've spent years researching both. Why those cases?
Well, thanks all for inviting me to come on. It's a pleasure. And you guys are one of the people, one of the teams that inspired me to become a podcaster. So thank you for that. The Zodiac case, I started out on actually reading about it in high school. I was one of those weird teenagers in the 80s. That just the name Zodiac and the persona that came with it, I want to learn a little bit more about it. So I had a book on serial killers that I read, and then I got the book Zodiac by Robert Graysmith. you know, from there, I just read it and did a book report on it. And the teacher wasn't too happy that I picked that as a subject to write a book report on. But, you know, something just the sinister aspect of that case just grabbed me. And the fact that someone would call themselves Zodiac and write letters to the press and then attack people wearing an executioner's hood just really reeled me in. And I just, it sort of stuck, and grew up watching Unsolved Mysteries and stuff like that. But the Zodiac was one thing that really, really I attached to and stuck with.
Before the Golden State Killer, ears, ons, you know, the case with so many names was solved. Joseph James D'Angelo has been arrested, a man who is, I take a lot of joy out of seeing how frail he looks these days. Hopefully his time is coming to an end soon. He's like 75 or so years old. When you started diving into the Golden State Killer case, was that you kind of looking for some more Zodiac cases? I mean, Zodiac claimed that he would go on to kill and kill again, and he kept taunting us, sending communications with a growing number on it. Were you looking for additional Zodiac cases? Is that what led you to Golden State Killer?
Not really. The Golden State Killer, before the East Area Rapist and Iran's the thousand names he had, I was aware of the case because of some other researchers that thought they might be connected to the Zodiac case. I never did. They're two different kinds of killers in their MO and just totally in opposite ends of the spectrum. But I was aware of the case, and I used to communicate an email back and forth with the late Michelle McNamara, who obviously wrote a pretty impactful book on the Golden State Killer case. And she had reached out and asked if I had any interest in poking around in the Golden State Killer case. And I told her, you know, thanks, but I'm sort of wrapped up in all things Zodiac at the time. So she went on down her rabbit holes in the Golden State Killer case. And then after she passed away, I sort of reflected and felt guilty that I hadn't taken her up on that offer. So I sort of dove into the case, and, you know, I knew some different people that were investigators, and they opened some doors for me, and I became friends with some of the survivors and victims of D'Angelo's. And that's how I sort of went down that path.
Do we have an idea of how the Zodiac came up with his name, or is it just something random?
Well, that's sort of the thing. We don't really know. He's the one that gave himself that name in one of his early letters. He said, "This is the Zodiac speaking." And he signed most of his letters with a crosshair-looking cross circle. And there's a watch that's a Zodiac name brand watch, and it has a crosshair logo as its sort of as its symbol. So if you put those together, that seems to me like the most likely place that it came from. But there's all kinds of theories that he was maybe into the astrology and stuff like that.
Yeah, and we see things like mathematics, coordinates on maps, astrology. Of course, horoscopes have been famous and popular throughout time, especially in the late 60s. So there's all kinds of thoughts that can be applied to how this individual came up with the name. Obviously, he's going to want to pick something that sounds ominous. He wants to be threatening and terroristic almost in nature. And so it almost seems fitting to pick such a vague name, but also something that sounds a little evil, or at least mysterious.
Yeah, that's my take on it as well.
Now, we all know that killers can inspire other killers, or at least they tend to imitate one another on occasion. And as far as the Zodiac goes, some cases that come to mind immediately for me are like Son of Sam. I've always kind of thought of him as a Zodiac wannabe, kind of a sloppier, dumbed down version of the Zodiac. The Phantom Killer case out of Texarkana sounds like early Zodiac type stuff. And then just the idea of writing the letters and communicating with law enforcement and the press, I mean, that takes us all the way back to Jack the Ripper. What do you take, Mike, from any of these other killers out there? What do you think Zodiac took from any of these other killers?
Well, with the attacks of people in some of those areas, like on Lover's Lanes, where the Phantom Killer struck, or Son of Sam struck, those are easy opportunities and to find people that aren't paying attention. They're out in isolated areas. They're easy targets. And I think that's perhaps why he searched for people like that. And so I went searching for different cases across the United States with Lover's Lane scenario attacks, and they just started piling up so many I couldn't keep track. So that's a trend that's been going on early back, as far as back as the early 1900s, where people would be attacked. The key difference is someone like Son of Sam or Jack the Ripper sending letters and notes and correspondences. That's very rare. So when Zodiac did that, you know, that was rare. You can go through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases in California, and there were lots of bad guys running around, but most of them didn't want to communicate with police. They wanted to stick to their own attacks and not give the police anything to work with, whereas Zodiac seemed to crave the press, and I think that actually took over as his main motivation. And comparing that to the Golden State Killer case, for example, Joseph DeAngelo didn't really taunt the police or newspapers. He taunted victims because he liked reliving the pain that he inflicted on them, so he would call them years afterwards. But a little bit of a different thrill for him versus Zodiac wanting to see his name in the newspapers. I think that was a key difference.
The first confirmed attack for the Zodiac at Lake Herman Road was, in essence, a success for the killer. He achieved what he set out to, or what we can believe he set out to achieve anyway. He successfully attacked and killed both of the victims and didn't find himself in a situation where there was much of an eyewitness to identify him as the killer, with the exception of one witness saying they possibly saw a white vehicle parked near David Faraday's vehicle on that night. That leads us to a similar but slightly different situation at the next confirmed attack at Blue Rock Springs, where he is unsuccessful in the sense that he leaves one of the victims alive. He intended to kill both of them. We know that based off of his phone call. He's calling to report a double murder, not realizing that he left one of the victims alive, Mike Mageau. One thing I found interesting about this attack in particular, variations of stories and what went down, how the attack went down, and just the couple of events leading up to the two of them being parked at Blue Rock Springs Park. Can you take us through, maybe not necessarily the changing stories or the different versions, but it looked to me, Mike, that most of these different versions are coming from Mike Mageau. Is that correct? And what are your feelings on the different variations of these stories?
Yeah, Mike Mageau's story has changed a lot over the years, from July 1969 when it happened to recently. He was featured in a 2007 documentary that came out with the Zodiac movie DVD release, and his story changed quite a bit. In essence, early on, he said that he had been picked up by Darlene Farron, and they decided to go to Mr. Ed's, a local hangout that was popular with, you know, most younger people. For whatever reason, Darlene got creeped out while there and decided to drive away and go get some privacy, and they decided to go to Blue Rock Springs Park, which is very dark. And again, it's one of those areas where people might go to hang out, to make out, whatever. And that's where they wound up. Some key things that happened were, after they were there for a couple of minutes, some kids came in, threw some firecrackers and stayed there, raised hell for about 5 minutes, and then left. But just after that, a car came in and pulled up next to Darlene's car and sort of just sat there. And Darlene and Mike had the conversation, "Do you know that person? Who is that?" And they didn't really know. And after a minute or two, the car drove off. So they sat there listening to the radio talking, and then about 5 minutes later, a car came back that Mike thinks was the same car, and it came into the parking lot, pulled up directly behind them. someone got out, shined a bright light into Darlene's car, blinding essentially Darlene and Mike, and then he walked up to Mike's side, and they actually thought it was the police. So they proceeded to start getting their licenses out, and Mike looked up and was shot immediately through the window, and Darlene was shot. Both of them were shot several times. That's been consistent for the most part. The shooter got back in his car and was about to leave, and Mike started flailing around after being shot, and the shooter got back out of the car and fired two more shots into Darlene's car, hitting Mike again and Darlene. And then this time he drove away. That's always been consistent. That's what he said early on. But in the documentary years later, there's some things that change. He mentions that they were being chased and pursued from Mr. Ed's at high rates of speed. And that's not what's in the police report. Nothing like that. He says that they just decided to go there instead. Darlene was driving. And then early on, they didn't know who the shooter was when they were having conversation amongst themselves. But then he injects, hey, the name was Richard. She said something about Richard. And if you watch this documentary, it's plain to see that he's suffering from maybe mental illness, maybe some kind of addiction. I don't know. I don't know what he might be suffering from, but I think that's affected his account of what's happened over the last, 50 years.
In his initial report, he's saying that the vehicle was very similar to Darlene's. So it would have either been a Chevy Corvair, or others have said maybe a Ford Mustang, because they would have had similar body type. And he says it was pretty much the same color as Darlene's, maybe a little bit lighter. What are your thoughts on the vehicle description?
Well, I think because it's so dark out there, and he's probably, his intentions are to make out with Darlene, he probably wasn't paying a lot of attention. And I think a lot of cars back then looked a lot alike. So for him not to be able to pinpoint the details of the car, I totally get that. I understand that. But I think based on what he said, it did have some kind of similar features to Darlene's own car.
The thing that jumps off the page to me in regards to the first two attacks, not only are they very close in proximity, I think it was roughly about 2 miles distance between the first double murder and then the double murder attempt that left Mike Mageau alive. When you cross-reference the events of that night, the stories I found, Mike, say that both couples went to Mr. Ed's restaurant and drive-in prior to going and parking. And I mean, that just jumps off the page to me, because I'm sitting there thinking, if I'm some dude in my late 20s or however old Zodiac may have been at the time, if you're looking for a car involved in young love, Mr. Ed's makes a perfect sense to park there, hang out there in the dark hours of a weekend night, or a Friday night for that matter, and find your prey there and follow them to where they end up parked.
Yeah, that's the happening place back then was Mr. Ed's. You know, there's an interesting connection in that one of the Lake Herman Road witnesses, just not long before the shooting on the road that night, worked at Mr. Ed's. So there's that connection as well.
One thing that's very different about the Blue Rock Springs attack in comparison to the Lake Herman Road attack is that the Zodiac then calls the police dispatcher and says, hey, I just committed a double murder. Here's where you're going to find the kids in a brown car. And by the way, I killed those kids last Christmas as well. There's a decent gap in time, minutes missing there, about 20 to 30 minutes based off of our ear witnesses of when the couple was shot at Blue Rock Springs and when the phone call came in. What are your thoughts on what Zodiac could have been up to during that time frame? I've always found it a bit bizarre. We know he wants to report it, or else he wouldn't have called it in, but it doesn't seem like he made a mad dash from the crime scene to the payphone, which would have been, depending on which route you use, roughly 7 to 11 minutes travel time. He didn't make a mad dash to get to that payphone. Any thoughts on that, Mike?
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting things about that attack, because the call is probably at least 30 minutes later, probably closer to 40 minutes later. But it's, you know, rounding it, it's around a half hour, we can say that. And to go that distance, it's only a few miles. And the phone booth was at Springs and Tuolumne, which is, you know, in a more populated section of town, whereas Blue Rock Springs Park is this dark, undeveloped area out in the Vallejo at the time. So if the Zodiac wanted to get away and make a clean getaway and just keep driving, there's unlimited phone booths he could have called from, but yet he called from a phone booth in Vallejo, which is interesting. To me, my opinion is, and I try and put myself in the shoes of Zodiac when he's doing that, is that perhaps he would want to get rid of his car, get rid of his gun, stash it, because, you know, I wouldn't want to be driving around in a car with a gun in there just in case someone saw me. So I was thinking maybe he lived close to that phone booth and perhaps put his car in the yard, put his gun in the house, and walked to the phone booth. But there's, you know, again, that's speculation. But he certainly could have made it out of Vallejo if he didn't live in Vallejo and wanted to get away and then called from a different phone booth.
Do you think he called police to mimic somebody like Jack the Ripper? Or do you think it was simply because I committed these crimes and because it's stranger on stranger crimes, the police might not make the connection that it was me?
Yeah, I think maybe a combination of that. I think, number one, he wanted the attention. He wanted police to know what he had done. I think it was a way to rub salt in the wounds of these police officers to say, hey, I did this, I'm bragging about it, and there's nothing you can do about it. The phone booth was actually not far from the police station, which was interesting. So he might even be able to see police when they finally got the call racing out of there and maybe got some kind of thrill from that.
It was almost the perfect crime. Everyone was distracted, their attention elsewhere. Stacks of cold hard cash sitting on the table unguarded. Who wouldn't be tempted to slowly reach their hand out and steal a pile of Monopoly money from the banker? Monopoly is one of those games that can bring out everyone's most devious selves. And Monopoly Go takes that gleeful mischievousness to your phone in a wildly popular twist on the classic game that you can play throughout your day, anywhere, anytime. Collect rent from friends on iconic properties, bankrupt them by pulling a heist on their vault. And Monopoly Go has timed tournaments where you can team up with friends to unlock big prizes and try to top the leaderboards. Whether you're helping out your friends or going head-to-head for riches, Monopoly Go is an absolute blast. Download it now free on the App Store or Google Play. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Mine's feeling a little drained. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. What's the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/garage today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/garage. Have you ever thought about why your wireless bill is so damn expensive? It's all just radio waves. And how much can radio waves really cost? It seems like big wireless all got together and decided $100 a month. Now, thanks to Mint Mobile, you have a choice. For a limited time, all phone plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan.
Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. So ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited-time deal and get premium wireless for just $15 a month. I love Mint Mobile. They have great quality. They have wonderful service. I love saving money. Put them together, and I'm getting great quality, great service, a wonderful phone plan for only $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new three-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/TCG. That's mintmobile.com/TCG. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/TCG. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Do you think that he was local to Vallejo? Because I found it interesting that in the phone call, he doesn't just say Blue Rock Springs Park. Rather, he gives directions to find the victims.
Yeah, if I had to guess.
It's almost like he didn't know the name of the park.
Yeah, he does direct them pretty well. And if he would have said Blue Rock Springs Park, obviously they would have found it. But he gives them specific directions. Now, I wonder, that could be because maybe he does live there. He knows the area and he knows how to direct them there easily. But it also could be that he wants them to have no doubt that he did it and he's going to direct them right to the bodies. And at the time, he thinks they're going to be dead. But, you know, Mike Mageau survived. And I think he wanted to get them there as soon as possible so he could revel in what he had done.
And very interesting as well that given Mike Mageau's description of the shooter, you know, when the shooter comes back and then shoots Darlene twice and shoots Mike again two more times, he's able to get a description of what this guy looks like. And if, you know, given what took place in the second attack, we have to believe that the first attack with no survivors likely went down very similar. So based off of that, we can assume that in the description Mike gives us, Zodiac's not using any type of disguise at this point, and yet the next attack at Lake Berryessa is going to be significantly different, where the guy is disguised from head to toe. Is this guy, is he evolving? Why is he changing?
Well, that would, on my part, that would be speculation, but I think that the most likely reason is he realized after Blue Rock Springs, he left an eyewitness to the crime. And then the next attack at Lake Berryessa, he's attacking during daylight hours. So he's already left a witness. He knows that. And now he's doing an attack during the daytime. So I think maybe to keep himself from being identified, if something goes wrong or if a witness goes by, he's got that hood on. And another reason, it could be just to scare the shit out of the people he's attacking, because a guy walking up to you with that kind of executioner's hood on and a gun in his hand saying everything's going to be okay. If it was me in that situation, I wouldn't believe him, but he tried to calm them down when he attacked there, and that's what he was wearing.
Yeah. I almost feel like the mask had two purposes. Like you said, one, it's going to scare them more. And it seems like he's loves to see people's reactions, but also if they do survive, they can't identify him.
Yeah, I think it definitely serves multi-purposes, and I think he was very theatrical. We know that from a lot of the clues, and I think he probably enjoyed making that hood. It had the Zodiac crosshair logo on the chest, and he never mentioned, you know, to Brian Hartnell and Cecilia Shepherd at Lake Berryessa that he was the Zodiac. It never came up, and maybe that's because if something went wrong, he didn't want anyone to know that he was the Zodiac by that point and connect him to another crime. But it was, you know, later determine after he wrote on the side of their car door, that sort of changed everything, and they knew it was Zodiac.
Do you have any thoughts on what the mask was made out of? Or
the account varied from Brian. He said it was made with care. It wasn't just like some plastic bag that someone spray painted a white circle on. He said that the crosshair logo was stitched very nicely and professionally almost on the front. And the hood was made with care. It was draped over his entire shoulders and face. And there were clip-on sunglasses that were attached to the mask itself. So he pointed out that it was definitely made with care. It was made with some kind of professional quality. It wasn't just some bag that had white paint on it or something like that.
That's very interesting, because oftentimes with these serial killers, we will find that someone killing in the nature of someone like the Zodiac, where they're going out and they're killing people in a park near the lake or at Lake Herman Road or at the Blue Rock Springs Park, they're going out and they're finding their victim and they're killing them out on the streets or out in public in these, you know, secluded areas. Usually that suggests that they cannot kill at home. They cannot abduct people and bring them home, that they don't have privacy, that they don't have their own place. But then everything else that the Zodiac does implies that he does have a certain level of privacy. The making the mask in disguise with care, that's something that took time. The putting together the ciphers and the letters that he would later send, that takes time. And it takes, especially with the ciphers and the letters, I've seen it suggested that he probably had what he considered to be some type of workshop that maybe if he did live with other people, he had to keep under lock and key or guarded very tightly. But it's weird, the contrast between the two natures of the beast, if you will.
I've often thought about that, but I also wonder if it's just simply location. A lot of those housing developments in California, you know, where they're like these little Cracker Jack sized houses and they had really small yards. So it could be possible where he's going, well, I have privacy with inside my house, but I don't have privacy on the outside because the houses are so close together.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And in one of his letters, he did mention storing something in his basement, and police seized on that and thought maybe that's a clue, because most houses in the Bay Area did not have basements. So they thought maybe he had a little workshop down there, some place where he could get away from anyone else in the house and tinker around down there. But then again, Zodiac wasn't always honest in his letters, so it could have been an attempt at misdirection. Maybe he didn't have a basement, but that was something police were interested in. And I think it also goes into what kind of killer he was, whereas, you know, someone like a Golden State Killer wants to spend time with his victims, stay there, terrorize them, stretch it out as long as possible, get them alone. The Zodiac never had an interest in that kind of activity. He wanted to attack quickly and get out. So I think perhaps he never had an intention of bringing them back to his house or something like that. I think he was more of a thrill killer that got a thrill out of the attack itself, and then later on reliving it, I think that gave him some satisfaction.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because yes, I think he was a thrill killer, but I also think he executed the first murder so easily that by maybe contacting the police, it was another rush, because it was another point in the crime where he could get caught.
Yeah, and he was all about cat and mouse activity with the police and getting them to engage with him. And there's some evidence that he was inspired by comic books and movies like The Most Dangerous Game. And I think he thought of himself as this villain, or made himself into this villain called Zodiac. And I think part of the fun for him, part of the thrill from him, was that interaction with police. I mean, his murders, confirmed murders anyhow, they range from December 68 until October of 69. But then he's got a letter writing campaign that stretches until 1974. So he, at some point, it seemed like the thrill of the interaction with the police and the press was his letter writing and not so much the murders. It seemed like he got some kind of pleasure out of that part of it.
Could you list some of these comic books you think the Zodiac was reading?
Yeah, there's one called, and it's a Tim Holt comic book. And to give you a little bit of a backstory, he sent a Halloween card to reporter Paul Avery. And in that card, it was written by Fire, by Rope. I'm trying to remember it off the top of my head. But it was laid out in a specific image. And there's a comic book by Tim Holt. It's a DC Comics one. And I don't remember the title of it, but it's if you Google it, you'll find it. And there's a wheel on it. And Death by Fire, Death by Knife, Death by Gun, Death by Rope. It's the same things mentioned in the card to Avery. So from that, it's almost definite that's where he had to have got that from. When you base on some of the other clues, he mentioned the short story, The Most Dangerous Game. He makes references to theatrical stuff like The Mikado. So it seems like he was in his own fantasy world. And this person that he created, this persona, I really think he wanted to be some kind of arch villain or be known as one.
Yeah, I just looked up the Tim Holt comic. So it looks like it's actually titled Tim Holt. I think he's supposed to be maybe the hero. And it's issue number 30, according to what I found. But you're right. You have a man there, and I guess his name is Red Mask. He's tied up. And there's a Wheel of Chance behind him. And it's, as you said, Death by Gun, Death by Knife, Death by Rope. And yeah, it's very, very theatrical, very Zodiac-like. And it appears that this comic may have some value because it has some linkage to the Zodiac name.
Well, and also around that time period, there was a lot of comics that were, you know, these detective comics. And that's where we eventually get Batman from. I wonder if there's other comics that he was influenced by that people just haven't got the references yet.
Yeah, that could definitely be the case. And I think on the very least, we can tell that he's into fantasy stuff, you know, between the theater and the comic books. He's got, perhaps he's living in a fantasy world, you know, when I look at it as when most of these victims are young couples being attacked, they're out enjoying each other's company, making out, doing whatever those couples do. He's home reading comic books, and this is his world. So he goes out and strikes against those people that are doing the things that he wishes he could do.
Yeah, it's very, and the captain and I were talking about this earlier, it's very comic book theatrical like with the Zodiac. He's given himself this name, the Zodiac. He's given himself a logo, the crosshairs, and then he's supplying all these threats to via the newspapers and such. And then the costume at Lake Berryessa, it's almost, I mean, that's what a superhero supervillain is, the name, the logo, the costume. Now, you had mentioned the confirmed five, and there's a lot of suspicion that there are other attacks, and we can get into that later, but lay down for us why these are the confirmed five murders of the Zodiac Killer.
They're linked by MO and by handwriting. There's some latent fingerprints along the way. There's some palm prints on some of the letters, but police really haven't said publicly if any of those prints from various scenes or various letters match each other. So we know that they're linked by handwriting and by the MO, you know, in Lake Herman Road, once he claims responsibility for that, along with the July 4th attack, you know, we have a handwritten letter. he's detailing both crimes. He's accurately describing both crime scenes. So those two are linked together. Then when you get to Lake Berryessa, you know, he's doesn't say he's Zodiac, but he's wearing a Zodiac cross symbol on his outfit. And as he flees the scene, he takes the time to write a taunting message on Brian Hartnell's door. And it has the Zodiac symbol, and the writing matches the writing in the letters. And then we move forward to the murder of Paul Stein, which is the most unlike the first sets of crimes. Here we have another letter. So the handwriting again matches the previous ones. This time he actually sent a piece of a bloody shirt to the press along with the letter. So, you know, he's confirming that, yes, I killed him. Here's a piece of his bloody shirt. They verified it was. So you have all of these different letters and the MO of calling and writing to the press, linking everything here. Not like we have a DNA like we would have today or clear-cut fingerprints. But all of this stuff combined tells them that the same person was at all of these different scenes and is responsible for all these crimes.
Do you have a ballpark number of crimes that you think the Zodiac is responsible for? Or do you think these five are the only signature crimes from the Zodiac?
Well, there's crimes that he definitely hinted at that he was involved in. And I think he had a habit of trying to catch attention for other cases to prop himself up and make it look like he was even more of a villain than he actually was. You know, I try not to wander too far out of the five murder victims we know of. But, you know, I do look at some earlier crimes in that area. And then in Southern California, especially, there's some earlier crimes that could definitely be him. But there's so many bad guys running around in California at the time. There's so much crime that it's hard to go off, because then you start looking at, well, this crime looks like Zodiac, and then this one has some aspects. So I try to stick with the ones that have the closest MO to what we know Zodiac did.
What are your thoughts on Zodiac mentioning Deer Lodge, Montana, to the victims at Lake Berryessa?
I think that's a really important clue, but the thing I need to point out is that Deer Lodge is not necessarily what he said. Brian obviously was shaken up. He was scared. He was badly wounded. So he, when he was telling police word by word the conversation, he said it was something like a two-word name in Montana. Like, and he's trying to, you know, come up with ideas. And someone suggested Deer Lodge, Montana. And he said, yeah, that might be it. But there's been reports that it might have been a fern lodge. It could have been a red lodge. Something with two words in the name of the town. So it's, while most people settled on it being Deer Lodge, it's not 100% proof that he did say Deer Lodge. But, you know, there were no escaped prisoners, as the story that he gave them at the time, from Deer Lodge at that time. So I think it could have been just, hey, I'm going to tell these people a story about something I read 3 years ago about some kind of escape, and I'll tell them, you know, just to calm them down and get them to cooperate. And what he told them worked, and they cooperated.
Yeah, some suspect that Zodiac was a bit of a master of misdirection, and therefore Deer Lodge, Montana, or saying just the state of Montana in general, would be another example that he might be trying to misdirect people should somebody survive. Because what Zodiac has learned about himself by the time of the Lake Berryessa attack is that he's not perfect, that he did leave a surviving victim in his second confirmed attack, with Mike Mageau surviving that attack. And let's take that a step further, because there's some thought too that with the brown car, because Vallejo police said, they actively said this in the newspapers at the time, they gave a brief description of a young white man and a brown vehicle that they were looking for at the time. And he later, Zodiac later in a letter, confirms this brown car, saying, oh, well, yeah, somebody saw me in this payphone when I hung up the phone, the the phone rang, and this drew his attention to me, and that's when this witness saw me in the payphone and saw my brown car. And I love the idea of maybe, as you pointed out, it's dark. Mike Mageau has just been shot several times. He's traumatized. Maybe he doesn't know the color of the vehicle, couldn't see it. And maybe Zodiac loves this and goes, oh, they're looking for a white guy in his late 20s in a brown car. Oh, well, I'll confirm for them that I have a brown car when, in fact, I do not.
Yeah, what perfect way to divert the police and get them looking down a totally blind alley. And why would you describe the witness that saw you? He says that there was a black man that was shabbily dressed, saw him in the phone booth. They never identified anyone that reported seeing someone in that phone booth, but it sounds to me like that could easily be, I'm going to make this fake witness up so they're spinning their wheels looking for this witness that doesn't exist. I don't know why anyone that had just killed or thought he had killed two people would volunteer that information willingly.
I always thought too, given both of the first attacks took place on a Friday night in or around Vallejo, again, only separated by about 2 miles of distance or so. I always thought that in a sense, was a bit of misdirection as well, that he thought that he may have found the perfect place to kill. It worked out the first time. Let's kill there again. Now people think that I'm local to Vallejo, and that's why I always felt like he purposely made the call from a Vallejo payphone, yet didn't know the name of the park where he shot the two kids. It seemed to me this is the early stages of some of this misdirection.
Yeah, it definitely could be that. And I sort of go the other direction. I sort of go with, you know, a lot of killers start out close to home and then expand from there. You know, you've got someone mentioning these two areas that I'm going to attack. They're so close together, like you're saying, and then call from the phone booth in the same town. What better way to get people looking in Vallejo? One thing that's interesting is just about all of the letters Zodiac mailed were postmarked on weekdays from San Francisco. And most of his attacks, with the exception of Paul Stein, were on weekends outside of San Francisco. So does he live in San Francisco and he hunts on the weekends in Vallejo, or is it the reverse? Does he live in Vallejo and he's working in San Francisco during the week? I think one of the two is the most likely scenario.
If you guys had to bet, would you bet that Zodiac is single and living alone, or do you think Zodiac is married?
I wrestle with that, especially in the wake of the Golden State Killer case. I never thought the Golden State Killer was going to be a cop. I never thought he would have a wife and kids. So that sort of is made me go back and forth on the fence with Zodiac. I would tend to think that he's a loner that wants to be out with a girl on a date in a lover's lane parked in a car, but he's not. He's the one stalking those couples and attacking them. So I tend to think that he was one of those loner types that didn't have successful relationships. But again, after seeing what happened with the Golden State Killer case, nothing would surprise me. He could have had a big family and a nice job and everything else.
Well, I think Mike is right. And I think that we can see some of that in his crimes itself. We definitely see overkill in the women, and that's why we have more female victims, murder victims, and we have two situations where he attacks a couple and twice a male victim survives. So the female is definitely receiving the brunt of his anger in those attacks. And as Mike is pointing out, he's attacking and killing essentially what he envies. Young love parked in a car somewhere is what he would have liked to have been doing when he was a teenager or in his early 20s. He wasn't capable or wasn't successful in that realm. And so this is his lesson to you, general public. This is what you get when you park out in the middle of nowhere in the dark at night in these lovers' lanes. This is what you get. This is the lesson to be learned. Don't be out there at night. They're achieving something he wished to achieve but did not. And then when you take it to how is he living, who may he be living with, I think that he probably had some brief relationships with women and they failed and didn't work out, and that only added to his anger toward the female gender. And I think that a lot of his actions, at least once we get past the double homicide, or I'm sorry, the second attack at Blue Rock Springs. So this would be, now we're at July 4th, 1969. I think after this point, he has a certain level of privacy. He has a certain ability to spend a lot of time working on these letters, these ciphers, the costume that he built for Lake Berryessa. So he has time. Now, that may mean maybe he lived with his mom alone and had the run of the house for most of the time. But yeah, I think that's what's interesting about the makeup of this guy. I think he had some level of privacy, and maybe that's because he was unsuccessful with women or traditional type relationships.
Well, and since you bring that up, my question, do you put Zodiac younger or older than 30?
I can say with all confidence today, he's older than 30.
Well, I'm just saying because it seems to me like somebody that, you know, any friend of mine or people I've talked to that, you know, look back on high school and that it wasn't the best time in their life. Normally by the time they're 30, they're over that and they could really care less. They don't hold a lot of resentment towards that. That's why I always wondered, is Zodiac in like mid-20s or late 20s and he's still angry about his unsuccessful attempts with women?
Well, you have to be an extremely angry individual to do any of the things that he's doing. So he's not normal like the normal people that you just discussed. He's not going to get over any of this. And that's obvious from his crimes. So in regards to his age, one, we have several crimes where he's described as being in his 20s, late 20s, maybe 25 to 35. This is from surviving victims and from the phone calls he made where the dispatchers are saying he sounded to be of this age, 25 to 35. Mike, you take it from there.
Yeah, I know that the Napa dispatcher, the police officer that took the call from him after Lake Berryessa, described him as a student's voice, someone in their early 20s. Brian Hartnell described something along those lines too, not a real deep, mature voice, but more of a younger person. But again, people have all kinds of voices, and you can't always put a voice with a face when you see it. So we can't always go by that. But then you've got the eyewitnesses, as you talked about, and the possibility that Officer Falk saw Zodiac after Paul Stein's murder. There, he thinks he's a little bit older. And it's interesting, in the sketch that came out of Zodiac after killing Paul Stein, the original estimate and the original sketch was estimating the age to be 25 to 35. And when they amended it, it moved it up from 35 to 45. So I sort of look at the 25 to 45 window. I know that's a big spread, but I sort of feel that sometimes some of the things he does is very juvenile. I look towards a younger person, and other times some of the things that he's interested in seem like they might be more of a mature person. So like the Mikado opera, you know, like nowadays I try and compare it. I don't think there's any kids out there today listening to opera. And if the same thing's true back in 1969, I would think that that might be more mature person. So I sort of wrestle myself with whether he's younger or older.
Yeah, he definitely did some things that come across to me as very immature. I've said it before, I'll say it again. I don't trust anybody that doesn't use their real name.
Well, and Captain brought up a good point, too. He said that it's almost as if Zodiac's heart wasn't in the actual killing. He'd leave before people were actually dead instead of staying there, you know, ensuring they were dead or shooting them in the head. It's almost like he was squeamish about that part. And I think that goes back to he is playing this villain. He's putting this villain out there. The villain has to have victims. So he's got to do that part, even though he may not be committed to it. But after a while, he realizes, hey, I've built this persona up. I've built this reputation up. People know I mean business. I'm a killer. I don't even have to kill anyone anymore. Now I can just send letters, and I'm going to get the attention I've been craving that I didn't get in my everyday life just by writing letters now.
Well, and there's a good chance he almost got caught in the Paul Stein attack, the taxi cab driver.
Yeah, we see a lot of times with serial killers that they take souvenirs from their victims, or like you said, in the Golden State Killer case, he's harassing victims. Zodiac is harassing police officers. He didn't seem to take souvenirs. It's almost like his victims didn't matter so much to him. It wasn't personal towards the victim.
Yeah, there's no real evidence of him taking any kind of souvenirs, taking belongings of the victims. We don't see any of that, whereas the Golden State Killer would do that kind of stuff. So definitely two kinds of killers, and it seems like, you know, someone like D'Angelo has a connection, a permanent connection to the victim, whereas Zodiac, maybe they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time and he needed to kill someone to get credit for it.
So much more to get to tomorrow. Please join us back here in the garage. And if you need more of the Captain and the Colonel in your earballs, check out our bonus show called Off the Record. It's on Stitcher Premium.
Thank you to you, Captain. Thank you to Mike for joining us in the garage. You all better join us back here in the garage tomorrow. Until then, be good, be kind, and don't litter.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.